Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Well, the re-election of Scott Walker, despite his assault on collective bargaining, was followed almost immediately by the tweet from Mitt Romney's Florida campaign manager, "Unions, pack it in. It's over." Nothing specific there about health and pension pressures in certain corners of the public sector, just "Unions, pack it in. It's over." Coincidentally or not, Joe Nocera's New York Times column yesterday, with no mention of Wisconsin, was a meditation on the fall of mostly private sector unions as a factor in our national redistribution of wealth upward of the last 30 years. Joe Nocera joins me now to keep meditating. Hi, Joe. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me. My daughter actually emailed me the next day and told me that I was an idiot for not at least flicking at Scott Walker in Wisconsin when I wrote the column.
Ha. Well, I'll give you an opportunity to flick, if you want to flick, as we go along. But part of your column is about your personal history, your parents as union members, and then you growing up to regard unions with a kind of disdain. Where did that come from?
Well, excuse me. I think it came partly from having been, you know, I worked for the Washington Monthly, and as did a lot of liberal journalists, a number of liberal magazine journalists, and our famous editor Charlie Peters believed that part of the role of liberalism was to be willing to criticize liberals when they went awry. And, you know, he was one of the first people to start talking about excesses of the teachers union and, you know, how seniority shouldn't come ahead of performance and so on and so forth. And I think that got inculcated in a lot of people like myself. And we gradually, and then, of course, I've never been in a union myself. And so one gradually starts to mainly focus on what's wrong with unions instead of what's right with them.
But you've been thinking about unions in a new light lately?
Well, I was struck when I read Tim Noah's wonderful new book, The Great Divergence, which is a terrific, thoughtful work of economic analysis about what are all the various factors that have contributed to income inequality over the years. And the academics that he relied on are convinced that the decline of unionism probably contributed about 20% to the income inequality that we had today. And I was really struck by that. And that's what got me thinking about the decline of unions and the pressure on workers and the kind of the lack of a countervailing force when a Walmart, you know, pays, you know, $9 an hour or something, or, you know, minimum wage. And you need a countervailing force.
Your Walmart paragraph was really interesting, I thought, as an example of a non-union company who in the past would probably have had an organized workforce in the retail sector that would have pushed back to keep its wages and benefits in the middle class. Would you say that Walmart employees are often poor technically and getting taxpayer benefits to subsidize Walmart keeping more of the profit?
Well, I've certainly heard that, and I've also heard that it's also been fairly well documented that they can't afford to buy into the Walmart health plan that is provided for them, which requires a buy-in. So Walmart is just playing by the rules. They're playing by the rules in a particularly rough way. But you know, it's not Walmart's
job.
Walmart's giving consumers what they want, which is lower prices, and the cost of that is lower wages for the workers than they might otherwise. But it's the society that has to figure that out,
right?
Not Walmart.
Which part of the trade-off do we want? Lower prices lower wages, or higher prices and higher wages? You also cite a number from 2000 to 2007. There was a national reduction in wages and benefits that tracked the increase in shareholder wealth.
Yes, yes, and it tracked almost dollar for dollar. And the amazing part about that, Brian, is that the firm that figured this out and did this study was none other than J.P. Morgan Chase.
Hmm. However, the more conservative-leaning columnist, Greg David from Crain's New York Business, was here yesterday, and he argued on the show that the idea of rising inequality is exaggerated. Listen.
Well, inequality has grown over time. In the period from 2007 to 2009, for which we have statistics, the inequality declined sharply,
but
and the percentage of income of the lower of people at the in the bottom 90% grew dramatically.
And David went on to say,
inequality in the nation as of 2009 was no worse than it was in the 1990s.
So what do you think of that? Have you looked at any similar stats and come to a different or similar conclusion?
You know, it's sort of silly to say, let's look at this between 2007 and 2009. I mean, I think Tim Noah's book really quite profusely documents that, you know, from the post-war era up till about the early 70s, income inequality was decreasing, and that the middle class was getting more money and doing better, and the gap was narrowing. Now, we're not talking about the abject poor. We're really talking about the middle class here. And then from the 70s to today, the opposite has taken place. And I don't see how that's even possibly arguable. Now, do I have any studies right at my fingertips? No, I do not.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you read enough about this, it seems so well documented. It's sort of like climate change. You know, it's unarguable at this point, and yet there are people out there who will argue it.
New York
some will argue, some will argue on the basis of, you know, income inequality is good because it means the meritocrats are getting the money and they're the ones who deserve it. And some people will argue that, you know, it's overwrought, overblown, overstated. If you go around the country and it seems pretty plausible.
Clear people are hurting. Joe Nocera, New York Times columnist, my guest on WNYC, talking about his column yesterday on the decline of unions. And this brings us to Wisconsin. One of the few real union strongholds anymore is the public sector, but it has the real issue that states and localities are facing of fast rising health and pension costs for certain public sector unions. That's what Scott Walker was all about. Do you see public and private sector unions as moral equivalents?
You know, private sector unions are in a better place because they have a monopoly, but they're also in a worse place because governments can take away what they gave, and that's pretty much what's happening. But it's not that different, really, from what General Motors has gone through and the General Motors workers. You know, they had gold-plated health care plans and they had gold-plated retirement plans, which they don't have anymore because General Motors filed for bankruptcy, and those part of coming out of bankruptcy was an agreement with the unions to rewrite those and to lower the benefits for those workers. Now, what's happened across the country is that in the boom times, governments made promises to their municipal workers that they can now not afford to pay. And so the real question is not whether there have to be givebacks, because it seems unarguable that they're due. The question is, how do you go about this? And so you can go about it the Scott Walker way, where you basically abrogate collective bargaining and do it in a very aggressive way that is bound to stir up a lot of anger and blowback, which is good for him politically. Or you can do it in a, you know, Cuomo's gotten givebacks from state workers. But he hasn't, he's a Democrat. He wants them to still be his allies. So he hasn't done it in as overtly aggressive a way.
And wanting them to be his allies is an interesting point, because Walker's assault on collective bargaining was premised on the idea that public sector unions buy lawmakers through campaign donations in a way that they can't buy management in the private sector, resulting in these unsustainable pension obligations and things. And politicians can make these appear invisible at re-election time, especially if it's pensions which are pushed off into future tax years, but that private employers could never get away with their shareholders. So is there a special problem with the power dynamics of unions and politics that makes Walker kind of right about public collective bargaining?
Well, I don't think unions have the power that they used to along these lines, in part because the problem has become so grave, and we can't just kick it down the road further. But you know, he does have a point, and it is absolutely true that mayors and governors have, especially Democratic mayors and governors, have historically cut sweet deals with the municipal unions, and you know, it's now come a cropper. I don't think you deny that. What the problem with Walker is that he's gone about this. In addition to just saying we got to pare back the pensions, he's also said we have to eliminate your right to collective bargaining, and that's a whole different thing. And that's done in no small part because that's what will appeal to the Republican base. And, you know, there's a reason billionaires contributed tons of money to the recall campaign to make sure that he stayed in office. What he's arguing is very, very appealing to Republicans across the country.
Let's take a critic of unions calling in, 212-433-WNYC, Gary in Queens. Hello.
Hi. I'm not a critic of unions, but there are certain things that cause non-competitive, I forgot the term. But here, just to talk about what he, your guest, was mentioning, there is public employee unions require more taxation to fund their benefits and at the expense of other workers. If you take into account the taxes, such as what Wisconsin was experiencing.
But, Gary, you still have to ask yourself the question, even though it's tax dollars, what do you, as a taxpayer who is the employer, want your kids' teachers to be paid, want the police officers who protect your block to be paid, and how much is too little, right?
For the most part, the market takes care of that. But if you take into account the cost of living, as Wisconsin people, citizens have done, they think they can live better with less taxation, mm-hmm. and as a result, their income, effective income, goes up.
Gary, thank you very much. Let me go to Grant in Brooklyn. Grant, you're on WNYC. Hello. You're a union organizer?
I've been a union organizer, yes.
Uh-huh.
I think the point that's missing here is that most of the wounds that unions are facing right now are entirely self-inflicted. Unions are not out organizing new members into the union. That's why there's nobody in private sector unions anymore. And so public sector unions are left, and of course they're being sacrificed at the altar of conservatism. And I think if unions were to get out there and actually organize more workers in the union, more workers would join, they'd have more power, we wouldn't be facing these situations that we face in Wisconsin.
Why do you think unions wouldn't be organizing, which is kind of what would keep them in business? Is it because they became too focused on just getting the best deals for the people already in the unions?
I think that's part of their job, but I think part of it's expensive. You got to take risks. You sometimes fail. I think it's things.
Can I sneak in here?
Sure, Joe.
It's unbelievably difficult to organize these days. The deck is really stacked against the unions. You know, federal law makes the job difficult, and the ethos of the country in the wake of Ronald Reagan's firing of the air traffic controllers in the early 80s really gives corporations the huge upper hand. You know, when any time anybody's tried to organize at Walmart, you know, they shut down the store, they find ways to get rid of the organizers, they do whatever they have to do. So, you know, it strikes me as a little unfair to say they're not out there organizing, because it is sort of like beating your head against the wall.
So, Joe, do you think that government policy destroyed the union movement, or did market forces, or its own excesses?
All three. You know, unions have had a very hard time withstanding globalization, and you know the labor costs in places like Vietnam and China were so much lower. You know, it's irresistible for a company. They also did have lots of excesses, you know, corruption, an unwillingness to care about the greater prosperity and only caring about getting stuff for their members. I mean, I remember in the late 70s, don't you, where when inflation seemed to be out of control, and yet the unions were, you know, getting huge increases for their members, and which was spiraling inflation, and people were just tearing their hair out. But you know, so there's that too. And then the third thing is, I do believe government policy makes it very, very difficult to organize these days. And so I do think it's some of all three. I also think unions need to figure out a way to be more relevant in the 21st century. And I don't know quite what that way is, but organizing store by store, company by company, just doesn't seem to be a workable way forward.
Let's get one more call in here. Dan in Massapequa, police officer. Hey, Dan, we got to be real quick today, 30 seconds or so.
First, the more important thing that shocked the labor union is that when their constituents in Wisconsin no longer were forced to pay dues, about 30% of them withdrew from the union. That's what scared the heck out of them. You're right, because they don't participate in the daily lives of these unions. They take their money and they contribute to politicians and causes that the members don't particularly care for. And that's what really shook the unions to the core in Wisconsin.
What do you think about the police officers union here? I didn't want to go there, I guess.
I don't either.
Well, there are some successes in New York recently, though. You say you can't organize store-by-store, business-by-business. There's a domestic workers' bill of rights, something people may have thought they would never see. There's an effort underway now to organize car wash employees. So some things are taking place, at least here.
Well, you know, it is New York.
And it is.
It's not Wisconsin. It's not Woonsocket, Rhode Island, which is another town that is about to go bankrupt and is trying to figure out a way to abrogate their contracts.
All right. We are now living in the post-Scott Walker, surviving the recall election world. Joe Nocera, New York Times columnist, writing about unions in yesterday's paper. Thanks a lot, Joe.
Thanks a lot, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, NYU gets expansion approval again from the City Planning Commission, further alienating many of its Greenwich Village neighbors and dividing the university community. How much is too much? NYU. We'll talk to a reporter and take your calls coming up.